Hi, Big Grammar here. This is For the Record program number 1050, interview number 19 with Jim DiGenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 22nd of the year 2019. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to be joined on our airwaves by Jim DiGenio, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed, about the JFK assassination, and New Orleans DA Jim Garrison's investigation of same. Jim, welcome back.
Okay, good evening, Dave.
Before we continue our march to the sea, so to speak, with regard to the JFK assassination and Jim Garrison's investigation, yesterday was the official observation of the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, now a national holiday, although his actual physical birthday is January 15th. And on that day, there was an article published about a petition, in turn, that has been generated by a group. I've forgotten their exact name, but they are calling themselves the Truth and Reconciliation something, basically after the South African body, using that same name. And they are pushing for not only continued release of the relevant documentation about the assassinations, especially the JFK assassination, but also the reopening of the investigations into all four of the assassinations of the 60s, both Kennedy's, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. You, many other people, the brilliant political comedian Mort Saul, whom we spoke about in an earlier interview, your associate Lisa Peace, Oliver Stone, were among the signatories to that petition. So perhaps before we proceed with discussion of Destiny Betrayed, you would like to share some of your thoughts about that with the audience.
Well, the guy who really got this going is David Talbot, the former founder of Salon, and he's written a couple of pretty good books on the JFK case. That is Brothers and the Devil's Chessboard, which is really about Alan Dulles, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he started this at a private seminar up in San Francisco on December the 15th, all right, in which Dr. Gary Aguilar arranged that. And it's a way for the top researchers in the field to get together and share information.
Was that
and
this
so
past?
So Talbot started this. Mm-hmm. He calls it the American Truth and Reconciliation Process, okay? And he started it as a kind of, and I have to say, I have to give him a lot of credit. The guy's just getting over a stroke.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
You know, he has to walk with a cane.
Was that this past December 15th? It was a little over a month ago. Okay, because I knew he had had a fairly serious stroke, and that was too bad. His Devil's Chessboard, not only about the JFK assassination, but about Alan Dulles, the Galen Organization, and so many of Dulles' decades-long machinations. So, David Talbot is at least functional. He's now walking with a cane, and apparently still unimpaired in terms of mental faculties. That's good to know.
Right.
Continue,
and
Jim.
So he started this, and we were the first signatures he got, okay? And then later on that evening, he called Bobby Kennedy Jr., and Bobby Kennedy Jr. said he would sign on. Then he got people like Oliver Stone, Professor Richard Falk, okay, James Lawson, who was part of the SCLC.
Who is Richard Falk? I'm not familiar with him.
Who?
Richard Falk. I'm not familiar
Richard
with his
Falk
name.
Richard Falk is a famous professor. I think he's in the Ivy League, and he's done some very interesting books about American history.
Mm-hmm.
All right? He's one of these very few academics, you know, who will go beyond the borders of what I call the conventional wisdom.
Yep.
All right? And then he got Alec Baldwin, he got Martin Sheen, all right, he got King's nephew, okay, Isaac Newton Ferris, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, the daughter of Bobby Kennedy, all right? And he organized this very well-written and documented news release. And it managed to go ahead, and it got printed in London, the Daily, I think the Guardian printed it. All right, then there's the French newspaper, Nouvelle Observateur, which changed its title to OBS. Mm-hmm. That's in Paris. It got printed there. And some of the alternative media, like TMZ, Consortium News, all right, went ahead and printed op-ed news. They printed it in this country. Now, I'm waiting for any of the major newspapers or magazines to even mention it. Okay, so we're going to have to get some momentum going, if we hope to do that. Okay, but anyway, you can read the article at Consortium News, all right, and there'll be a way for individuals to go ahead and sign the petition in a few days. I wish it would have sorted out before, but there will be a way to do it later. Okay, so let's hope or keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully this might be able to do something. What I wanted to do, but they didn't do it, is I wanted them to send it to AOC. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, what's her name? Alexandra Ocampo-Cortez, whatever her name is, Alexandra.
Ocasio-Cortez.
Okay, yes, I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Yes, I wanted to send it to her, okay, and I wanted to say, look, here is an article I wrote about Bobby Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff he did before he got assassinated. He's pretty much in tandem with what you're talking about right now, by 1967, 68. So will you please sign this petition for us? But they didn't do it,
Yeah, well, so. There's a lot more that I noticed. Of course, I have spoken on this program about the heroic Dr. William Pepper's reopening of the investigation into the Robert Kennedy assassination. He
right.
has proceeded further not only with the conclusive forensic evidence that Saron could not have fired the shot, as the coroner's examination revealed, but the numerous shots that they've actually been able to at least partially de-mind control Saron. I noticed that Juan Romero, I believe that's his name, who was actually the busboy in the Ambassador Hotel, who was cradling the dying Kennedy's head, passed away at a relatively young age. I don't know if there's anything.
Wasn't that just a couple of months ago?
It was. I was wondering if you, being down in the L.A. area, knew anything about that, if there was any, if he had figured
no,
in.
No, I don't know anything. Paul Schrade was friends with him,
uh-huh.
But I didn't know Juan.
Okay.
But I'm sure everybody listening to your show remembers that famous photograph, of him cradling Bobby Kennedy's bleeding head in his hands
yep.
with a rosary, between them. Yeah, that has to be one of the iconic pictures of the 1960s.
Absolutely, although what people generally don't talk about is the clip-on tie lying by Kennedy's right hand
right.
that may well have come from Thane Eugene Caesar. That is a whole other can of worms, and I talked about that back in 1985, accessing the Christian Turner text about the Robert Kennedy assassination, a very good early book about the RFK killing. I had a lot of feelings seeing that petition. On the one hand, it was good to see that mentioned, and yet, one of the signatories was Mort Saul. And as he noted, and as we have related several times, in these interviews, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before mm-hmm. you belong to the lie? And for the mainstream media now, they could report on the petition saying, well, a bunch of, conspiracy theorists, blah, 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 blah. That is their little totem, journalistic totem, that they can wave in the air to dispel the demons of truth that might plague them in their ongoing endeavors. But How can they admit now, yep, actually, you know, the Warren Report was a crock, and the official version of the Martin Luther King assassination was a crock, and the official version of the Robert Kennedy assassination was a crock, and same with Malcolm X. I noticed that one of the signatories to the petition was Carl Evans, that's E-V-A-N-Z, who authored an excellent book about the assassination of Malcolm X called The Judas Factor, that I have access. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I do think it is worthwhile for people to take a look at that. If they wish to add their signatures, they may. I wish I could say, Jim, that in my 40th year on the air and, you know, after roughly almost a half century doing the research, I wish I could say I was optimistic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is... things have gone so
well. The opposite of optimistic is pessimistic.
Yep. Well, you know, as I say, I am jaded at this point. you know, partially, it is how I maintain my resolve to keep going. But I do what I do because I believe that people should have the right to at least understand the forces that control their lives. And this really, as I say, I don't even charge for my work. I'm only in it for the karma, so to speak. And this is my statement to the cosmos, so to speak, as an individual human being. This is who I am, and this is what I do. But it's also how I protect myself against too much disappointment. I remember being so optimistic. We will get next week, actually in our second interview today, we may get to some of the House Select Committee's material about Mexico City. But I remember being so optimistic when I read about the formation of the House Select Committee, and that got squashed. And I also know that another of the signatories to that petition was none other than Mrs. Blakey's baby boy,
Robert Blakey. Yeah.
And I can't discuss Mr. Blakey in all.
Well, we're going to talk about that later. Right?
Oh, we will. If I were really to unload, I would lose my FCC license because I'd have to use some very nasty words. But we will talk about him in professional analytical terms later, but you know, so we'll see. And I remember reading about George de Morenchild's quote suicide unquote just before he got interviewed, you know. And we'll talk about perhaps as a bridge to what we're going to talk about in our first interview. I remember all of the people who died on the eve of the House Select Committee on assassinations investigation, or just before they were going to be interviewed, Regis Kennedy, very important FBI agent who might have had some very important, in fact, I'm sure had some very important information to relay. He passed away on the eve of the investigation. William Sullivan, the number three man in the FBI, whom we'll talk about, was shot to death in a hunting accident the week before. He was going to testify, and it's just, I've seen enough of this stuff that, as President Eisenhower once said, and this is an actual quote, "I know I speak for the vast majority of the American people when I say the future lies ahead." He actually said that. So it's true enough. True enough. Jim, in our past interviews, we have spoken of the Richard Helms memorandum or directive that the Garrison investigation into Clay Shaw should occasion the neutralization of Jim Garrison and his investigation before, during, and after the Clay Shaw trial. And I'd like to discuss some of that here. Jim Garrison, continued to be the focal point of some manifestly unfair media coverage. Why don't we talk about a Look magazine article that you write about in Destiny Betrayed?
The Look magazine article?
Yeah.
Okay. That one was penned by Warren Rogers. And Warren Rogers, it later turned out, was a trusted, what they call in the trade, asset of the FBI. All right? And this was part of the movement to go ahead and cut off or discredit Garrison's attempt to go ahead and charge and convict Shaw for perjury, okay, after his conspiracy trial ended in acquittal, all right? And so Warren Rogers obviously was trotted out by, you know, somebody like Carter DeLoach to go ahead and give us a shimmering, angelic, everything but a halo on that poor Clay Shaw guy who has been, you know, manifestly crucified, you know, on Golgotha, you know, by that devil, Lucifer, Jim Garrison, right?
Like the Rodney Wilson
piece.
An
attempt to go ahead and discredit that move.
Yep.
And unfortunately, it was successful, okay? Because as we're going to find out in a few moments, Garrison never was able to put Shaw on trial for committing perjury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I alluded to Carter DeLoach, of course, a top FBI official at the time. You write about William Sullivan and his disclosures about Warren Rogers in his book, The Bureau, published after his death. I already, you know, made a reference to how Sullivan died and when, but you might want to relate that for us or repeat that for
us.
Oh,
my God. Oh, my God. Sullivan was one of the several people who was a very important person in the quest to reopen the JFK case, which began in around 1975, 1976. And what? And there were, well, There was Giancana, Rosselli,
right,
George de Morenschild.
Yep.
All right. And William Sullivan, who dies in, well, this is what they called it, a hunting accident. Now, Dave, I've never been a hunter, but I know that when those guys go out and hunt, they wear some very obvious clothes, you know, to mark them as hunters, like red and black checked jackets that show up very well in the snow, all right? But somehow we're supposed to believe that the son of Sullivan's friend shot him during a hunting accident right out of Dick Cheney, right?
Yep. It really is. I mean, again, Nietzsche once observed that a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling, and we're chuckling, and yet it is horrifying. And you made a brief reference to Giancana, Sam Momo Giancana, a mob boss of Chicago, who was involved in many of the mob CIA-connected Cuban machinations, and he was shot to death in his home in Chicago. I think shot like five times around the mouth while his home was under FBI surveillance. Okay.
Right.
And then Johnny Roselli, whom we've spoken about, and by the way,
who ends up in an oil barrel?
Dismembered. Yep. Dismembered. He wasn't speculating on oil futures. He was killed and dismembered in an oil barrel, which was found, by the way, floating in the surf at Biscayne Bay near Dick Nixon's Southern White House. And, you know, I don't think that could be attributed to a hunting accident. We'll talk about the Morenschild when we get to the House Select Committee. But this, I think, when I get frustrated with the lack of official momentum or even integrity in connection with these things, you know, we should not lose sight of what lies beyond that. You know, you got people like Richard Case and Miguel having a hand grenade thrown at them. I mean, when all else fails, you know, the mailed fist comes out, and it is quite remarkable. Hunter Leak, I love that there's an unintentional pun, I think, in his name, Hunter Leak. He certainly was hunting the leaks, you know. Who was he, and tell us about the teletype machine.
Okay. Hunter Leak was the head of the CIA station in New Orleans, okay, at the time of the trial of Clay Shaw, all right? And Hunter Leak was, let's put it, to put it mildly, was quite cooperative, okay, with the CIA during the Shaw trial. There, he actually moved a teletype machine into the station, okay, during the Clay Shaw trial. All right. Go ahead and relay bulletins to CIA headquarters in Washington, D.C. They liked this so much, and they feared Garrison so much, that they actually made this a kind of piece of the furniture, all right, in at the CIA headquarters, all right?
Wow.
And so Hunter Leak kept this up, you know, monitoring of Garrison, you know, even, and I have to go back to the memo from Helms, you know, plans for countering Garrison before trial.
Yeah, Jim,
so that's
what
we're going to talk about today.
You dropped out just
what
a little.
They did after the trial,
right, Jim? You dropped out just a little bit. If you would repeat the Helms directive, we've alluded to it, but you dropped out for a few seconds there.
The Helms memo to the Garrison group was to find ways of countering Garrison before, during, and after the Clay Shaw trial. All right, and so this was obviously part of the after. What are we going to do about this guy after? And that's why Hunter Leak kept the ticker machine inside of his office, all right, you know, after the trial was over. You would think that after Shaw was acquitted, well, they wouldn't be doing this stuff anymore. But that's not what Helms wanted. Helms wanted the complete destruction of Jim Garrison, you know, by hook or crook. He was going to go ahead and remove him from office and destroy his investigation and, as we're going to see, incinerate his files.
Yeah. Well, they sure continue. By the way, the Garrison Group is the CIA amalgamation that was put together to neutralize Garrison. We spoke about that in an earlier interview. Jim Garrison then moved to, he actually got a perjury conviction of Dean Andrews. He then moved to try Clay Shaw for perjury about denying that he was acquainted with David Ferry. And, and I believe Oswald as well. Anyway, the story of the attempted perjury trial of Clay Shaw is once again illustrative of what took place. Tell us about that trial, Jim, in particular, the remarkable switching of venue in that trial.
Well, this is a very, what's the best way to describe it? A really in American jurisprudence.
Again, Jim, you dropped out for just a second. A really what?
Okay, this is a really kind of remarkable episode in the history of American jurisprudence, because what you had here was the complete, total taking control of this attempt to try Shaw for perjury by Shaw's defense team and the judge, Herbert Christenberry. Now, how did this happen? Right after the trial, the wife of Judge Herbert Christenberry sent Clay Shaw a very affectionate and sympathetic letter, all right? And Shaw obviously went ahead and showed this to his attorneys. And so what does attorneys do? Once Shaw was charged with perjury, they moved to go ahead and move the trial from a state court to a federal court. Very, very, very unusual, okay, to move a trial venue, to keep it in the same city it's in, but to move it from a state to a federal court, all right? Very unusual, all right? Now, once that was done, Okay. Kristen Berry just happened to be on the circuit, okay, where the trial was located, and he became the trial judge. Okay? All right. So before, now remember, Shaw has already been indicted for perjury. Okay?
Right.
And Garrison was going to use some of the best witnesses he had, which he did not use at the trial, all right, this time around. Okay, I've actually seen the roster. There's going to be like 9 witnesses, okay, this time around, on whether or not Shaw knew David Ferry and Oswald. All right, so what happens is that Shaw's lawyers moved for a preliminary hearing, all right? And who did they call to the stand? It was not their client. It was not any of Garrison's witnesses, all right? It was Garrison. And so what happened now, in a very, very weird turn of events, is that all of the disinformation that had been pumped into the media by people like Walter Sheridan, like people like James Phelan, now were used to nail Garrison on the stand. Okay? And Kristen Berry went ahead and backed it all.
Yeah. He did.
Amazingly. He let it all go ahead and play out. And sometimes he went even further than, for example, James Phelan did. He literally accused Garrison of using post-hypnotic suggestion on Perry Russo, you know, which, of course, is preposterous, all right? But that's the kind of stuff that played out. And so what happened is that Garrison never got to the trial phase in this thing, all right? And Kristen Berry decided to throw out his whole case before it ever approached an opening statement, all right? Just based on this preliminary hearing, it was thrown out of court. One of the most ridiculous things, you know, which I don't think, and this is why I did some work on it, and I spend about 2 or 3 or 4 pages in the book about it, you know, because I don't think it's ever gotten the attention that it should get.
Amen, Jim. Before we continue, because I want to interject another couple of elements, I would like to read from page 315 a little bit of Carolyn Kristen Berry, by the way, that's Christenberry, and her letter to Clay Shaw. It begins, "Our most sincere congratulations, exclamation point. We shared your, no, we, you point out that we, she's not just speaking for herself, but for her husband.
Right.
We shared your anxieties over the past 2 outrageous years," unquote. The note goes on. "Should your case have eventually found its way to federal court and been allotted to my husband, you most certainly would have had a fair trial. He felt we should not risk the possibility of being considered, quote, prejudiced, unquote, in advance. This is our reason for not openly expressing these sentiments earlier." The point being that both Herbert and his wife, Carolyn, were not only friendly with Clay Shaw, but deeply biased in the case. Before we get on to some of the interesting witnesses, in addition to the fact that Garrison basically became the defendant, you go into a very important piece of political history or judicial history about Herbert Christenberry and the assassination of Huey Long. In a nutshell, fill us in about the kingfish and then how Christenberry behaved in connection with the Huey Long assassination.
All right. This was work done by Professor Donald Gibson. And I think it's pretty interesting. Most people don't understand or don't recall just how controversial that Huey Long was in Louisiana. And I think a lot of the mainstream media has kind of smeared Long But at his best, Huey Long was a full-throated populist who was against the accumulation of wealth by the giant oil cartels. And because Louisiana had so much oil in it, okay, he was going to actually make them pay fair dollar to the state of Louisiana to be able to build their oil derricks within the state and offshore. All right? He, because of the speeches he gave against the wealthy cartels, he was targeted by Standard Oil. All right? And so he was attacked by them, right, in more than one venue. And they sent infiltrators into his camp. All right? Well, Christian Berry and his brother said that they were actually working, okay, for Long. Christian Berry's brother was his Treasury Secretary, all right? And they said that they had somehow found out where the plot to kill Long, the conference to do it, took place. And they had gone ahead and overheard it from the next room and gone ahead and typed up a transcript. And the eventual accused assassin, Carl Weiss, was at that meeting. Well, guess what? All the evidence that was supposedly taken for trial disappeared for a very long time. All right, for about 60 years. Harry Williams, who wrote the definitive biography of Huey Long, tracked down the last guy who had the transcript. And that guy said, look, Weiss's name was not in that transcript.
By the way, Carl right. Weiss was the fellow who was fingered officially for murdering right. Huey Long, and who, by the way, was shot to death on the spot by Long's bodyguards. So he, rather right. like someone, some other people I can think of, were not able to stand trial because they were killed beforehand.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So it looks to appear that Christian Berry and his brother were playing around. Okay, as pseudo Huey Long people, all right, who were actually kind of playing a double game, all right, and this is the guy who then goes ahead and presides over what is essentially going to be the end of Garrison's investigation. So, in other words, he was around for the end of Huey Long. And now he's going to be around for the end of Jim Garrison.
And covered up for the very powerful Standard Oil interests in the assassination
yes.
of Huey Long. And framed a lone nut who was killed on the spot and didn't stand trial for that assassination.
Correct.
And this is the CV, so to speak, of Herbert Christenberry. The point being that he had a proven track record of, on the one hand, obscuring important facts and really being a political fixer who could be counted upon to do whatever sort of machination was called for.
Right. I agree with that.
And he was the fellow who presided over the quote, perjury trial of Clay Shaw, really a public crucifixion of Jim Garrison beyond what had already been done.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
One of the points I made in several past interviews, Jim, is that perhaps, in light of that petition with which we began the talk, perhaps the most important part of your very important book is how you lay out the synthesis of the intelligence community's efforts against Garrison, the individual infiltrators into Garrison's investigation, how they networked with the agencies, the media hatchet people who were recruited by the intelligence agencies and who worked with the infiltrators into Garrison's trial, and how they in turn networked with not only Clay Shaw's defense, but with the Federal Department of Justice. Now, review for us who William Gervich was and how he played out in the perjury trial.
Well, Gervich, of course, we talked about him before.
Right.
He was one of the double agents who was sent into Jim Garrison's camp rather early. And Garrison, about a little bit too late, found out about him, all right, and got rid of him. And then Gervich essentially went to work for Clay Shaw's defense team for about 2 years. And he is one of the people who Kristen Berry calls to the stand, all right, at this phony hearing to testify about Jim Garrison.
Yep.
This is how upside down this thing got. You know, this is how wild it got.
Yep.
This is how unfair it got. You know, I mean, this is really kind of the edge of ridiculousness, if you ask me. Yeah,
it should be ridiculous, but I think it is at one level deeply tragic and at another sinister, and yet another for people today perhaps altogether terrifying, because it really, I've described that synthesis. What that really is a fascis, F-A-S-C-I-S, the root image and term for fascism, because when the chips are on the table, you've got that deadly synthesis of that I have alluded to. And Gervich, once again, embodies that synthesis. James Phelan was a witness at the actual Clay Shaw criminal trial. So, again, I cite your magnificent work in this regard. And, you know, I'm not flattering here. I'm a tough bastard, and when I use the extravagantly praising terms that I use, it's because they are justified, and you should feel very proud of having done something that is difficult and will remain unpopular to the mainstream. But I think for the observer today, this is how it works. You know, this is the reality of our country, and it is very sad that things have gone this way. But, you know, the powers that be were not done with Jim Garrison yet. We have spoken about Pershing Gervais and his activities. I'd like to go into that at greater length in this talk. Tell us about Pershing Gervais and how he was recruited to fulfill the directives of the Helms memo.
All right. We just talked about how the union of Shaw's lawyers with Kristen Berry essentially and finally got Shaw off the hook. All right. The other thing that the CIA wanted to do was to remove Garrison from office. The problem was that Garrison was a pretty popular DA. So they decided they were going to go ahead and smear him with charges of corruption. And so they used Gervais as their prime witness. It turned out that Gervais was running a racket based on his experience in the DA's office. All right. He would take money from prospective people who wanted the DAs to go ahead and prosecute a crime, and he would say, I'll get this one heard for you, and then you just have to pay me a fee when you win. Well, this, of course, was all unauthorized. Garrison didn't know anything about it, so he was essentially, Gervais was essentially running a racket, okay? And so the feds found out about this, and they decided to use him, okay, as a way to go ahead and get to Garrison. In other words, we've got you nailed. If you don't play ball with us, you're going to jail. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Gervais did. And so what they did is they went ahead and they sent him to Canada, all right, and they gave him a phony name, all right, because the idea was that we do not want Garrison to be able to track down our witness, because if he's allowed to depose him, then the whole thing is going to go up in smoke, because it's as phony as a $3 bill anyway, all right? And so that's what they did. They sent him to Vancouver. They gave him a phony job at General Motors, where all he had to do was sign in and sign out and collect a paycheck. All right. Except there was one big problem, is that Gervais didn't like Vancouver. All right. To go the, you know, the climate going from New Orleans to Vancouver is pretty different. All right. And so he didn't like it. And so a couple of reporters, one from Canada, one from New Orleans, tracked him down. All right. And they went ahead and they interviewed him. And Gervais more or less spilled the beans. Okay? I'm here because the federal government wants to get Garrison. All right? And I'm here under an assumed name because they don't want him to find out about me. All right? So the trial charge was that Garrison was involved in bribery from some pinball operators. Okay? They were running a racket. And the reason they were not arrested is because they had bribed Jim Garrison. And this is what they did. Now, first of all, let me say, this did go on, but Garrison had nothing to do with it. It was the local police chief and a couple subordinates who were involved in this, all right? And so they put Garrison on trial with these other guys, all right? They manufactured a case with Gervais. Gervais had worn a wire, okay, in his last conversations with Garrison, and he had been told to go ahead and borrow some money from Garrison, then we'll use that to be the payoff between you and him on the pinball operations, okay? All right? And so at the trial, this was all exploded. All right, because number one, Garrison found out about Gervais and the whole interviews he did up in Canada. All right. Number two, he brought in an acoustical expert, all right, who found out that the federal government had played with the tapes. Okay. In other words, they had interspliced the tapes with other tapes to make it look like something it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then, you know, he went ahead and put the pinball operators on the stand and said, have you ever talked to me? No. Have you ever paid me for this? No. Do you know who I am? He says, well, from the newspapers we know who you are, but no, I don't know who you are personally. Okay. And then he brought in some of the guys who had worked in his office, you know, and then they said, you know, did we ever avoid prosecuting pinball operators in the whole time that you were there? And they said, no. You know, you had done at least as much as anybody else and more than most of them. Okay, and so Garrison was acquitted. See, but this thing, because they delayed the trial for so long, they deliberately delayed it so it'd run right up against the political campaign being run by Harry Connick. All right? And so it did. The trial ended like a month before the race, and Connick was backed by some pretty big people.
Yeah, again, let me jump in for just a second, I think, as something of a transition element from Gervais. And what you have revealed was basically the outright framing of Jim Garrison. We should also note that this also played into the meme of Garrison, the mob associate, and we'll get to that, the perpetuation of that meme when we talk about the House Select Committee, etc. But John Mitchell, the Attorney General for Richard Nixon, was involved in the numbering of bills that were, quote, to be paid back, unquote, to Garrison, thereby obviously indicating that the Department of Justice was involved with this. And back in the criminal trial of Clay Shaw, Harry Connick was there representing justice. So review briefly for us, because we've got about 15 minutes left, about Harry Connick, what he did in the original trial, and then
Harry Connick was a local U.S. attorney in New Orleans. And he had been assigned through the Justice Department, being run by John Mitchell, all right, at that time as Attorney General, to be the liaison between the local New Orleans aspect, okay, and the Justice Department in Washington, who were completely monitoring the trial day after day after day. Well, now that they knew that they could trust this guy, they decided to go ahead and run him against Jim Garrison. And the frame-up of Garrison was not just confined to the local DA, Gallinghouse. He had help from Aaron Cohn, a former FBI agent, who was sending him all kinds of information that he perceived about Garrison not doing enough for organized crime. They sent a Justice Department task force down to New Orleans to get some headlines, you know, saying that how Garrison was somehow soft on organized crime. And this, of course, emanated from the Attorney General's office because it was Mitchell who had been monitoring the trial of Clay Shaw. He had given instructions about how far Regis Kennedy, the local FBI agent, was going to go in his testimony. And, of course, he was cognizant, you know, of everything that was being done in this obvious frame-up, you know, to get Jim Garrison. He was aware of it the whole step of every way, you know. And that's how bad when you think about it, that they wanted to go ahead and – now, this is something that somehow, you know, gets lost in translation – these guys were trying to put in jail a rather exemplary district attorney in New Orleans who had served at this time by about 10 or 11 years and had done a really nice job in cleaning up the DA's office and had made it one of the most efficient and well-run offices, you know, in the whole southern tier of the United States. And they now want to put him in jail simply because he had the guts and the honesty to go ahead and try and open up the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. That's what this really amounts to. You know, that's why Michael Perini sometimes calls this, you know, the gangster state. Okay, and everybody involved in this whole charade knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Okay? That's how bad it was.
It's also interesting that John Mitchell was party to an attempt at associating and framing, frankly, Jim Garrison for mob associations. He was Richard Nixon's attorney general. Nixon's first congressional campaign was bankrolled in part by Nicky Cohen, the syndicate boss of L.A., acting through one of his lawyers, Murray Chotiner. So the ironies here are profound. Again, Harry Connick, one of the, I think it would be fair to say, manipulators for the government in the Clay Shaw criminal trial. And some of the people whose names we have seen before come into the Harry Connick campaign to replace, ultimately a successful campaign to replace Garrison. Tell us about WDSU and the Gervich brothers' work on behalf of Connick.
Right. Okay. The Gervich brothers, who had been infiltrators in the Garrison's camp, okay, were a part of Connick's campaign, as was WDSU, which was the local NBC affiliate down there. All right. And they ran a lot of propaganda against Garrison, including a phony poll, okay, that said that somehow Garrison was losing. See, Connick ran against Garrison twice. The first time Garrison won, the second time he was defeated. All right? Garrison was defeated, you know. And for the second time, they really loaded up on Garrison. Okay? They were people like Shaw, people like Bringier, people running the whole Superdome project, which was in its infancy back then, okay, they began to raise a war chest, okay, for to defeat Garrison, all right? And like I said earlier, the trial did not end until about a month before it was over. And that's how Connick got into office, because between WDSU and the local newspapers smearing Garrison over these phony charges, you know, and the fact that it wasn't over till about a month before, Garrison didn't have a chance to go ahead and neutralize them. You know, he only lost by 2,000 votes. And let me add one other thing. Anybody who's familiar with Harry Connick will understand that going from Garrison to Connick was a huge elemental drop-off, because Harry Connick's DA's office in legal circuses, in legal circles, has become infamous as being a center for illicit and sometimes illegal tactics in order to frame innocent men, you know, and most of the time the illicit tactics did not become public until it was too late, all right? I mean, he's the only DA I can think of who was actually spoken about, all right, for the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually named him twice as using, you know, very unethical tactics to frame innocent men. And I talk a little bit about that in my book. All right, but anybody can look this up online. I'm not making it up at all. All right, it was a tragedy for the people of New Orleans what happened to that DA's office afterwards.
Yeah, I was not familiar with that, but again, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it doesn't surprise me, but some of the references that you have cited and a keyword search. Carlos Springer, very briefly, from the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, Peel, part of the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban colossus, was a part of the interview on WDSU with Ed Butler, Lee Harvey Oswald et al., and had a leading question of Oswald, tending to make him look like an anti-Kennedy wacko. And we'll come back to the DRE connection when we talk about the House Select Committee and George Joannides. The Gervais IRS pinball scam also resonated with the Gervais pinball scam also resonated with an IRS attack on Garrison. Fill us in briefly on that, if you would, Jim.
The IRS?
Yeah, yeah.
IRS was supposed to... This is so bizarre, I can barely even keep a straight face talking about it. All right. It wasn't bad enough that Garrison was innocent of this whole racket about the pinball operators. The IRS then piled on and said that, wait a minute, you made money off this thing and you didn't declare it on your taxes, so we're going to file charges against you again. Now, I will never be able to understand how something like that could happen, you know, but it did. All right, so Garrison had to go to trial a second time on these phony IRS charges, you know, which is, you know, which seems to me to be so incredibly nutty, you know, that it could only happen, you know, with a politically charged Justice Department run by the likes of John Mitchell, you know. So, but that is what happened. That's how nutty this whole thing got.
Clay Shaw's nuisance lawsuit. Tell us about that.
Oh, and then Clay Shaw filed a lawsuit against Garrison, all right, saying that he was unjustly accused. Clay Shaw passed away before it could go to trial. And so Ed Wegman, one of his lawyers, assumed the lawsuit, even though this was highly, highly, you know, circumspect legally, that somebody not related to the person in the lawsuit could go ahead and then continue the lawsuit. So Garrison went ahead and appealed this, the civil case, all the way up to the Supreme Court. And finally, I think in 1974 or 75, you know, that lawsuit was dismissed. So these are all the things that Garrison had to put up with simply because he wanted to reopen the Kennedy assassination. And believe me, in thinking all this over, in my opinion, the reason all this was done, the reason of this smearing of this rather kind of exemplary DA, you know, was not just to do this to Jim Garrison and smear his name, but it was to set an example, all right? Because theoretically, I don't know if you know this, but theoretically, almost any city in America could reopen an investigation into the Kennedy case. It's not really, you know, limited by the geographical boundary, okay? You know, and so, in my opinion, this was done to set an example. It was essentially to say, look, this is what we did to Jim Garrison. If any of you guys have any ideas about trying to do this again, we're going to do it to you.
Yep. Jim, we've got about 3 minutes left. I suspect that the treatment meted out to the late Gary Webb was very similar in terms of an exemplary intimidation of potential journalists who might
cross. Right, I agree with that.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Speaking of journalists, before we wrap this up, once again, Mrs. Phelan's baby boy, James, and James Kirkwood, his protege, and the hatching of that book and the hatcheting of Jim Garrison that they did.
Yes. All right. Phelan and Kirkwood and Ainsworth went on local TV after the Shaw trial, and they essentially propagandized that, see, look what happened. We told you all along. It was ridiculous. All right. Okay. And then Clay Shaw got James Kirkwood, who was a rather young author then, to go ahead and write this horrendous book about the whole affair called American Grotesque, okay, which I think was published in 69 or 70. And because the trial transcript was not available, all right, that was the book that everybody referred to for quite a while, you know, and it's a wildly one-sided propagandistic work, all right? Today, fortunately, with the birth of the Internet, we can go ahead and read the trial instead of having to rely on Kirkwood's one-sided view of it.
Although apparently Rodney Wilson of the Huffington Post, whom you spoke about, fell for the official okey-doke in that regard and, you know, just basically parroted the old canards about Jim Garrison and, you know, the mob-linked homophobe who had no case about, you know, St. Shaw. And it really is depressing. Also, we spoke earlier about George Lardner, the journalist who interviewed David Ferry just before he bit the dust, I should say. And then he does a hatchet job on Oliver Stone's JFK. Before the movie came out, Oliver Stone, one of the signatories to that petition that we alluded to at the very top of the interview. Jim, your website, where they can order not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK, The Evidence Today, and Black Op Radio.
Yes, my website is kennedysandking.com, and there you can go on. There's ads for both the books, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, and the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, which is the more recent one. All right. And I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's show, Black Op Radio, out of Vancouver on Thursday nights.
Very good. So people who would like to learn more, there are some places and vehicles for doing the same. This concludes For the Record program number 1050, interview number 19 with Jindy Eugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 22nd of the year 2019. For Jindy Eugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.